out of yourself, out of time, but it does all kinds of things. It takes you backwards in time. I mean, aren't our memory lands full of music? There are tastes and sights, but there are many songs which go back to your childhood, which bring it back to you with a certain intensity. And I didn't realize until recently, until I was preparing this lecture, how many Cole Porter songs were part of my musical land. The land is sometimes a bit bumpy, of course, but there's a lot of lovely songs in them. And that's what I tried to suggest by this picture by the pop artist Roy Lichtenstein. He's referring to pop music, popular music, which is the phrase normally used for the 20s and 30s, the great American songbook, when Broadway and then Hollywood were dominated by people like Oscar Hammerstein, Jerome Kern, Irving Berlin, and Cole Porter, one of the great songwriters. He was very different to the others. Someone like Irving Berlin came up from the street, he was a singing waiter, and it was a rags-to-riches story, whereas Cole Porter was a rich, not a poor boy made good, but a rich boy made bad, because he bled being a bad boy, but he was very, very rich. And he was against the stream in a way, because he was born, as I show you, in a very privileged background. He was never short of money. And that's one of the interesting things, that he had a lifestyle. He fully enjoyed his wealth and traveled around the world. And in many countries, he was inspired by what he saw locally, and it influenced his music. My entree to Cole Porter was, I suppose, some of you might be in the same boat, via Frank Sinatra in the 50s, the golden age of the LP, when LPs were put out in the classical field as well as in the popular music field. And there are so many Cole Porter songbooks, Ella Fitzgerald, Django Reinhardt, because Cole Porter wasn't only part of musical comedy, he became a jazz standard, and all kinds of jazz musicians did variations on Cole Porter tunes. There is at this moment a big revival, I'm not sure about in Cape Town, but in musical comedy. In Paris, for example, which has never been particularly musical comedy oriented, to Broadway and so on, they're having a lot of success with Sound of Music at the moment, and My Fair Lady. And in Broadway, there's a big revival of the Anything Goes by Cole Porter. Now, how many of these songs have got under your skin? And I've got you under my skin. What is this thing called love? That long lost love. Anything Goes, just one of those things. I presume there are a lot of them are familiar to you, are they?
Yes.
You're sensational in that case, because c'est magnifique. And I suppose the best known songs of all are Night and Day, and also the best known show is Anything Goes. And because of the technical problems today, I hope you will also agree that Anything Goes. In the old rain days, a glimpse of stocking, but not something shocking. Now I don't know. Anything goes. With all this, you won't see better words. Now I don't use four letter words, writing cards. Anything goes. The world has gone mad today, and it was bad today, and that's white today, and there's night today, and most buyers today, that's one of price today, are just silly as you could hope, etc. So I hope. I've got better people singing it when the tapes come. I understand. Let's face the music and dance, or what is, there's no business like show business. You smile when you are low, so and until the refreshments come in, I'm trying to smile and trying to get a kick out of this whole show. Now, I said to you, there are curse on a 30,000 songs, and I mean, there's something to suit all tastes. Because he just lived for music, Cole Porter did. He lived for several other things too, but music was so important. And he was one of those lucky people who couldn't distinguish between work and play. Because he chose music to be his work, he was always playing and always working at the same time, and that's a wonderful position to be in. He actually did work hard at his play, at his music, and many hours a day, but it was such fun. For the first, until he was in his mid-30s, he did it just for fun at parties. He was a hell of a social party boy. He was born very rich, as I mentioned, and he aspired to high society, and the cafe society, the high society. He's a snob. And he loved grand parties, and he grabbed the piano and sat down at the parties. So a lot of the time, he was just having fun, and some of the fun turned into music which he's lived on. And that's only for starters. I don't know how many of you recognized his support. And some of them were, of course, he specializes in, this was the Roaring Twenties. This was the time of flaming youth, the jazz age, reaction to the First World War, anything goes, risque, rather naughty, ooh-la-la stuff. So there are lots of, you just look at some of these, quite a few of them are a little bit on the naughty, naughty side. Still more, let's do it, let's fall in, etc. It goes on and on and on. And of course, this major body of work has attracted many biographies. Many biographies have been written about him, and many critics, live music critics, have talked about Cole Porter. It goes on and on. Ending up with a zombie dance for said. Anything goes, perhaps, for a zombie dance for said. And he was, although he was a late starter, because he didn't need to particularly work hard because of all his money, he was very much recognized before his death in 1964, I think it was. And he's recognized in America. It's very important to be on the cover of Time magazine. He was on the cover of Time magazine. His image was on the American postage stamps, as you can see. He was given all kinds of degrees by his old university, Yale, by Williamstown, special concerts in the Metropolitan Opera. Very much recognized at the end of his life, and inevitably, even in academic situations wearing academic garb, the speeches to him always ended up with, "And it may be on the bottom, you the top." Cole Porter was seen as the top, you the top. Now this is this is one of the, we'll catch up and show you the movies when they come. This is a gap for where the moving thing comes in. Now he was recognized throughout the world, and it's not yesterday's music, it's today's music, or the day before yesterday. Some of you might have seen the Cole Porter tribute in Cape Town given by the City Ballet just a year ago at Maynard. Well, I unfortunately missed it myself, but I hope quite a few of you saw it. It was based on a whole medley of his music. And how many of you have seen Midnight in Paris? Oh yeah, a lot of people. When I suggested this course, I didn't realize that Midnight in Paris would be on at Cape Town, and it decided months ago. So it's a happy coincidence, because so many people have said, "Oh, Cole Porter, Midnight in Paris." Midnight in Paris is, of course, about time traveling, and when this man starts hallucinating today, back in the Paris of the 1920s, there's Cole Porter at the piano, and I'll play you just a little part of that when it comes. Because Paris was where the action was in the 1920s. The First World War had been so horrible. People were dying in the trenches, the collective suicide, it seemed to me, of Europe. That when people got out of the war, there was such a feeling of exhilaration. And let's make the most of it. Let's live it up. Let's do it. Let's fall in love and all that kind of thing. And of course, Paris was where a lot of the action was. It's where the modern art movement took off a new start. Some of you might have heard of the big exhibition on in Paris at the moment, centered on Gertrude Stein. There were a whole lot of American expats who came to Paris, lived in Paris because it was cheap, and changed the life of Paris quite a lot. Gertrude Stein has a big exhibition ending now in Paris. It's been in San Francisco, moving to New York. And by the way, someone like Gertrude Stein made modern art, because Picasso and Matisse and many other modern artists were unknown. She put a spotlight on them, bought them, and made them fashionable. And did that with many other, with many, many artists. So Gertrude Stein is one of the makers of modern art. Other people who here comes some rescue. Thank you so much. I think I will, yes. Now we can start having the movies instead of Mr. Stills. There are, of course, people like Hemingway came to Paris, Scott Fitzgerald, the man who is, symbolizes the glamour years of the 1920s and 1930s. Parties were, of course, the centerpiece of his novels, like The Great Gatsby and Tender is the Night. And the word, the Jazz Age, was coined by Scott Fitzgerald. Well, Scott Fitzgerald was in Paris. Hemingway, of course, was in Paris. That's where his career got launched, for The Sun Also Rises, Fiesta, all kinds of other foreigners, James Joyce and so on. But above all, American expats were very influential in the intellectual life of Paris because, as Gertrude Stein said it, Paris is where the 20th century is. It's where things are happening. It's where the avant-garde is. And there were also, in dance, for example, in the Théâtre des Champs-Élysées, the big Russian ballet craze. The Russian ballet never performed in Russia. The Russian ballet performed in Paris. People like Diaghilev and Stravinsky and Nijinsky in the Théâtre des Champs-Élysées. And of course, it was very avant-garde art, and that's such shocking to a lot of people. One of the most hullabaloo evenings ever spent in Paris at the Théâtre des Champs-Élysées was when The Rites of Spring by Stravinsky was put on, and people started booing and shouting, and it was a riot. So a lot of this art was very, very new, and Cole Porter was part of this expatriate crowd. He, in fact, also got launched in the same theater that The Rites of Spring and Josephine Baker performed in. So Paris was the place to be, and Cole Porter was definitely part of that big, expatriate, cheerful life in Paris. We've been through
this.
Oof. Well, Cole Porter is very much alive, as I pointed out, even in Cape Town and in the movies and so on. But for a long time, he's been considered as sort of an American popular music classic. He's already in the sort of, shall we say, in the museum, or rather in the archives of American television, for example. He's, you know, he's on a pedestal in the archives. And here's a...
Thank you.
Age Madness is one of the subtitles for it, when everything went. Because the 1920s, after the disillusionment of the war, people were experimenting politically. They were trying fascism, communism, and other isms. In art, or neo-impressionism was behind them, fauvism and surrealism. There's something very surrealist about lots of Cole Porter's lyrics. He joins strange things, incompatible things at first sight together in a surrealistic way. And people were all kinds of isms, mysticisms of various kinds. And Cole Porter expressed that exploratory, experimental side. He would experiment with new things very much in his music. And then I think you just a reminder to you who've seen from the film, The Night in Paris.
Not to mention the famous folks in Siam. Think of Siamese twins, some origins.
But anyway, while he was alive, there was a biopic short, not too long after his death, there was a second one, It's the Lovely. So there have been two musical biographies devoted to Pearl Porter. And here's the carry-ons. Sorry.
Just about.
dropping, place dropping, going from Camembert to Fred Astaire, putting in many of his people that he was very fond of and had a lot to do with. Fred Astaire, he had a lot to work together on many things. Irving Berlin, the other great songwriter, did a lot for Cole Porter, and they were very good friends. It was in fact Irving Berlin who suggested to the Hollywood studios that they make a film of Cole Porter. So there are sort of personal things, and yet this love of travel, which comes through all the time. The Nile, and the Paris, and the Tower of Pisa. He was mad about travel, extraordinarily restless. He was a foxtrotter when it came to dancing, and a globetrotter when it came to traveling. I'm not sure where... Can we get those lights off?
That's the door.
Oh, they're here somewhere. Is that Clint? Is Clint around?
I'll get Clint.
Well, now, I mean, I've given you... There are 1,000 songs he wrote. Let's try and boil things down a little bit and look at the major themes. The themes in his work, of course, were his times, Anything Goes, The Mad, Jazz Age, that side, his life and times, topicality. He wasn't too interested in politics. Until Eisenhower came around, he wasn't too keen on any of the presidents. He wasn't interested in politics as such. But what was happening in the world, topicality, was very important to him. And of course, high society, as always, what a swell party this is, and that kind of thing. And then travel, that was a big obsession. Just a little selection of some of the travel references. He did a musical comedy which didn't really take off, it was called Around the World in 80 Days, the Jules Verne thing. There's no cure like travel. A song called A Sightseeing Tour. Every day is a holiday. Let's fly away. All songs by Cole Porter. And then he refers to Paris, Padua, Venice, Martinique, Java, Siberia, So Long, Samoa, Suez Dance, Mexican Hayride, Adios, Argentina. He covers the whole world. And even quite interestingly, in terms of what's happened in China lately, one of his songs is called Come to the Supermarket in Old Peking. But of course, I'll get on to that in a moment. I'm going to actually now start getting to the biography. But first, the themes in his music. Of course, the big theme, and I mean, some American professor of music calculated that 80% of all the hits tunes were related to love. Love is the big subject, of course. Darwin sort of said that love and music go together as the form of mating or whatever it is. All the varieties of love interested Cole Porter very much. So let's just look, as you suggested, look at his biography a little bit. Here's a reference to Anything Goes, the times, and it's typically set on a moving ship because that's his travel. And he did many around the world tours, coming to Cape Town, for example, in 1938. On the Franconia and many other cruise ships. So travel was very important to him. And the big question is love. What is this thing called love? I mean, what are the different aspects of love? The great loves of his life were his mother, I will get to that in a moment, and his wife, but lots of other dalliances along the way. We have Barbara Streisand. Barbara Streisand singing.
There's a funny thing.
Hungry, yearning, burning inside of me? Is it just one of those things? Or is Love for Sale, that is a scandalous song, which Love for Sale, which is about a prostitute singing. Or is it Nice and Domestic and Cozy, You'd Be So Nice to Come Home To. Or You Do Something to Me. All the variations on the love theme were dealt with in Cole Porter's music. And of course, as always, he liked to be Uluru Rizke. Doris Day.
So come on, get on with it. So Cole was bullied
by his grandfather to do something serious, instead of which he did something rather unserious. He just loved music, and his grandfather supported it, but his mother backed him. His mother backed him very much, and he started playing at the age of six, had a violin as well as a piano, and composed his first song in honor of his mother, Song of the Birds, when he was 10 years old. He loved music, and as I mentioned earlier, he found a way to ingratiate himself with his classmates, was to act up, sing, and be a clown, all the world was a clown. And his grandfather said, get him to a boarding school. Off he went in his teens to the Worcester Academy, a boarding school, not in his hometown, so he was away from his hometown for the rest of his life. And then his grandfather insisted, now that you've gone, when you've got sort of matriculated, you get on to Yale, one of the top Ivy League colleges. So Cole was sent off to Yale, but his grandfather thought he should become, you know, study accountancy, economics, the serious subjects, not the lightweight sort of music and those soft subjects. So Cole Porter, but his mother always defended him against his rather tyrannical grandfather. And here's a picture of Cole Porter on the far right, growing up in that small town, the rich boy from a small town. And here's a picture of what the town looked like in his time, 1,200 people, and quite a prosperous town, although not nearly as prosperous as the richest man in the town, Mr. Cole. Here's the house, which has been revamped a lot, that he grew up in. And it's now become a museum. The people of Peru are very proud of Cole Porter. They have a Cole Porter Day every June. And you can go to the Cole Porter Museum. And you can visit the museum and buy a Cole Porter doll. And there is a museum. I think it looks much like Cole Porter today. It's the Cole Porter Museum, the Cole Porter doll. And he went on to Yale. Where he first studied serious subjects, but he loved the musical side of things, and he composed so many football songs. He wasn't a good footballer at all, but he found he could become popular by composing football songs, and Hail, Yale, and many, one or two of his songs are still in the repertoire at Yale University at the moment. It was, of course, an extremely distinguished university, and there he preferred, instead of the serious subjects, studying poetry and music. Didn't like someone like Wordsworth too much, who was too serious. Loved the bad Lord Byron, and bad Lord Byron's travelling ways and philandering and so on. And Robert Browning was another favourite. And he took as his theme throughout life, carpe diem, live the day, live the moment. And he liked the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam, come fill the cup and in the fire of spring, the winter garment of repentance fling. The bird of time has but a little time to fly, and lo, the bird is on the wing. Unborn tomorrow and dead yesterday, why fret about them if today be sweet? Make the most of the day. That became his property of philosophy. A hedonist, pleasure-loving philosophy for the rest of his life. After Yale, his grandfather said, now off to Harvard and study law at Harvard, so he was marched off to Harvard. But here's a picture of him still at Yale, finding that he could be popular by song, by being a cheerleader. They dressed up rather formally for cheerleaders. There's the Yale sign at the bottom, wire for Yale, Cole Porter, one of the cheerleaders on the left. It's interesting to note that cheerleading seems to lead to higher things. Several American presidents were cheerleaders at university, Reagan, Bush Sr., Eisenhower, and one or two others. So cheerleading was an upward mobile. So between sporting life, and then of course he started, didn't only compose music for football, but he composed musicals for the Yale students, which they took on tour in small towns around America and big towns as well. So music became his life, but hidden from his grandfather, of course, to whom he pretended that he was getting on with his law. But he did finally drop out and go to New York, given money by his mother. He inherited from his grandfather later when his grandfather died, but he grandfather's money came to him by his mother when he was young. Friendship was always an important thing. Camaraderie, together with Yale men, he had Yale friends for the rest of his life. And one of his songs deals with this friendship idea. You've always got to be stick by your friends when they're down the well, look after them. And one of the lines in the song, which I'm about to play to you, which is called Friendship, says, if you go out to dine and you lose your teeth, borrow mine. That's a kind of absurd song that he went for. But so listen for that particular phrase, plus other things about friendship. It's about a couple who become estranged and decide to be friends in one of his earlier plays, and it's sung by Red Skelton and Lucille Ball. And it's one of the earlier roles of another great dancer, apart from Fred Astaire, who featured in many of Carl Porter's musicals, Gene Kelly, in a minor role. So there's friendship between Skelton, Ball, and Kelly.
People like Hemingway were, of course, wounded in Italy.
Many young men were killed, some of Goldwater's friends were killed, and towards the end of the war, many young Americans went over to Paris to help with relief work and to in ambulance services and being there to get France back on its feet again. So the war was the big experience which changed so many lives and made people question everything, hence the anything goes feeling after the war. And those, after dallying around in New York for a while, Cole Porter found himself to, around 1918 in Paris. And here he is. Well, he's not here himself, but that was the scene in Paris. He discovered he'd already been to Paris. Because of his grandfather's money, he'd been sent to France when he was 17 or 18, stayed some time, learned French, traveled around in Europe as a spoiled rich boy, and loved France from the word go. But now he went over to Paris, meaning to stay for quite a while, and he joined the American army people. They're all sitting here at Café de la Paix. In later songs, Cole Porter incorporated the names of many Parisian cafes into his music, the Café de Dôme and the cafes of Paris. He loved Café Society as much as he loved higher society. And to these military men, he was very proud to say that he had been in the French Foreign Legion, which was the most macho, tough battalion you could think of. They still create a stir when they come down the Champs-Élysées on the 14th of July. What could be more macho than being a French Foreign Legionnaire? Well, Cole Porter was a French Foreign Legionnaire, or so he said. And in many biographies, it's always mentioned that he was a French Foreign Legionnaire, and some they even say he got the Croix de Guerre. And he himself dressed up in various uniforms, and it's in many of the biographies, it still is, that he was a French Foreign Legionnaire. But recent research has shown he never ever was. He was in various ambulance services, and he did play a sort of peaceful role in the war, but he was never a legionnaire, but he always claimed it. And of course it added to his allure. He made all kinds of claims. Fact and fiction were always tied up in his life, were always confused in his life. He claimed to have gone to Romania when he was young and learned gypsy music. He kept changing his statistics, his age, his height. He said certain songs were composed here and there to flatter people. He said, I was thinking of you when I sang it. I was there when I went. So it's terribly unreliable. It's all very interesting, but to be taken with a pinch of salt. What is clearer, though, is not that he wasn't in the French Foreign Legion, but his favorite place in Paris was hardly in Montmartre or Montparnasse or the Bénimé areas. He just loved the Ritz Hotel in the Place Vendôme. That's where he felt most at home. There were some American banks around that area. And the Ritz was, of course, terribly grand and had an interesting, rather saucy reputation. The Prince of Wales, Edward, the British Prince of Wales, had gone to the Ritz for all kinds of dalliances. And it's even said that the Ritz installed king-sized baths after Edward went to the hotel and wanted to have a bigger bath so he could have a girlfriend in the bath with him. Of course, Edward was called Edward the Caresser. The British monarchy has had Edward the Confessor and Edward the Caresser. A lot of caressing was done in the, I don't know what the Duke and Duchess of Windsor later stayed there quite a lot, I suppose, quite a lot of caressing. Anyway, it played a key role in Cole Porter's life. He just loved, he moved into flats for a long time, stayed there. He spent up to 6-7 hours in the bar of the Ritz. Wrote several songs about a little old corner of the Ritz, and I like to have my tea. He said, I think he had rather stronger thing than tea. I like to go there for my afternoon tea, to sit and watch the kings, and let the queens watch me. But he kept his eyes open in the Ritz because he attended a very fashionable society wedding, and there he met his wife. He met his wife, Linda, who was a society beauty from an old southern family in Kentucky, with enormous taste, good looks. She had her first marriage, though, to a media mogul, an American media mogul, who had treated her rather roughly and badly. So she was off macho men. She preferred gentler treatment, and they had an asexual marriage that suited both of them, and got married, but it lasted for all of her life. So they met in the Ritz, spent a lot of time in the Ritz, took fancy apartments in the Ritz, and it was really important in their lives. Some more pictures of the Ritz. And of course, the bar Hemingway. Hemingway claimed to have liberated the Ritz after the Second World War, so a bar's named after him. It should have been called the Cold Porter Bar, because he spent much more time there than Hemingway did. But anyway, there is the Hemingway, pictures of Hemingway, and Cold Porter is remembered in the Ritz, but not as much as Hemingway. They did know one another. Hemingway mentions a Cold Porter song in Snows of Kilimanjaro, one of his stories. Here's the Ritz again. And here, incidentally, this is a matter of interest, is the suite which Princess Diana stayed in before she left the Ritz to die in that accident in Paris. Someone else who lived in the Ritz most of her life and who was a good friend of Cole Porter was the fashion icon Coco Chanel, who changed the way women looked, adapted to the modern look it was dictated by Coco Chanel, the most influential fashion designer of her time. She was with the Duke of Westminster for a while, had a very interesting life, and lived in the Ritz and died in the Ritz. And Cole Porter devoted some songs to the princesses dressed in Coco Chanel dresses and that kind of thing. And amongst them, of course, were the Windsors, who were big, as I mentioned, friends of the Porters, and spent a lot of time in the Ritz as well. Here's a picture of the Porters together. She had intellectual tastes. She's wonderful for decoration. She knew people like George Bernard Shaw, literary people, and the very famous American art critic Bernard Berenson was a very close friend of hers. So she gave him a big sort of cultural push, was very ambitious for him. Thought he should try his hand at more serious kind of music instead of just the Broadway music. But when he started succeeding with light music, she was hugely supportive, kept elaborate scrapbooks, keeping every detail of his career. So they were a very close couple. And I somehow think that this picture by Marc Chagall, a lovely picture, was in Paris at the same time as the Porters were. Represents the marriage of the Porters. You see that he's on the shoulders of his wife, as he was on the shoulders of his mother beforehand. She became a kind of a mother figure. And he's draining his glass. He's having a drink. Cole Porter was very addicted to drink, became rather alcoholic later on. And some guardian angels are watching over them. Remember the song, and I used to, guardian angels on high, with nothing to do, from one of the songs. So guardian angels are looking while he's on his wife's shoulders drinking, and he's got one hand over her eye because he didn't want her to know what he was up to, because for him, gay Paris was very much gay Paris, both in the modern sense of the word and in the older section of the word. But he was always true to her, darling, in his fashion, but he had flirtations galore as he went along. He was very sociable and met lots of people and had good times with them, but always in his way remained very faithful to his wife. And they bought a wonderful hotel particulier in the 7th arrondissement of Paris, which is the aristocratic area near the Invalides and near where the embassies are, with hotel particulier, all those courtyards and so on. and this is in the room this year. And when I last checked on it, it was not for sale at the moment. Funnily enough, the estate agents are pushing the sale of this place, but they don't mention that as a gold border house, funnily enough, just 13 rooms here. But as you can see, it was rather elaborate from the outside, a courtyard. And Linda Porter, Carl's wife, decorated it with zebra carpets and lots of oriental porcelain and pictures, and it was a real meeting place for higher society in Paris. But Linda tried to get Coldwater to get serious, and he went to a very important avant-garde music school called the Scuola Cantorum, which is still an institution in Paris. Many famous modern musicians like Satie, Eric Satie, and others went there, and he sort of beautifully trotted off to this music college. But his mind was rather on social life, the high society of Paris. Over the years, they got to meet people of various royalty, the Aga Khan, the Rothschilds, all the sort of high society of Paris after all the grand parties. And people who represented that, as I mentioned before, were the Fitzgeralds as well. Scott Fitzgerald is the great writer about parties being almost a mystical experience in The Great Gatsby, and in Gender is the Night, and gave his name to the Jazz Age. He imported it in no one in particular world, but they moved in the same circle. And this is one of the parties in Paris, slightly more bohemian one, given in honor of Josephine Baker. And cocktails, Carl Porter was avant-garde. He was the man who introduced Tom Collins cocktails to Yale and to other places. He was very much into cocktails. But he did appreciate French wine, all kinds of drinks, and drugs as well. He was addicted to any kind of experience. And one of his songs says, "You don't sing enough, you don't dance enough, you don't drink the great wines of France enough." So this was the Roaring Twenties, Charleston time. Gertrude Stein earlier on, was the Princess de Polignac. She was born into the Singer sewing machine family and inherited a lot of money. Moved over to Paris, married first one prince, then another. The second prince, she got on very well with. It was what was known as a lavender wedding and asexual wedding, because they each had preferred their own sex when it came to those questions. And it was another light cold waters wedding, as a marriage as well. But she was a great believer in modern music, Debussy and all of Satie and the Six. And she still has an institution in Paris devoted to promoting modern music. And she was a link between Cole Porter and his first musical show in Paris, which we'll come to in a moment. Here's Winnaretta Singer. There she is in older age. Princess Polignac. And this is the kind of state, the way she lived in Paris. That was the aristocratic high life of which Cole Porter was a part. And she introduced him to the Théâtre des Champs-Élysées, which I mentioned earlier, which was the launch pad for the Ballet Russe, the Swedish ballet, for Josephine Baker. And Cole Porter's short play called Beyond the Potter, and a musical play which he wrote with his friend from Yale, Gerald Murphy. The Théâtre des Champs-Élysées, which is on the Avenue Montaigne, close to the Seine near the Champs-Élysées, that's where his sort of career took off in Paris. And he did move in the circles of Diaghilev, who was the big Russian impresario of the Ballet Russe. But the two of them didn't see eye to eye on musical matters. And also there was perhaps some rivalry over this man called Kochner, who was one of Cole Porter's boyfriends, one on the left. And then, of course, there was Josephine Baker. I talked about famous American expats in Paris. She was the most famous of all, called the Black Venus, or the Nefertiti, the African Nefertiti, who captivated Paris by her dancing and was the queen of the music hall. Josephine Baker came out to South Africa, and I gave a talk on her some years ago, and some of the audience had heard her in Johannesburg. But she was a worldwide star based in Paris. And she also sang Cole Porter, but in French, because he was translated into so many languages. I've got you under my skin in French.
Amour de près, amour de vivre loin.
sang a song about in Paris. It was a perfect part in the world. And Josephine Baker was the toast of the town. You saw the painting by an artist, Kiss Van Domen. This is the Espace Cardin, it's called in the Champs-Élysées. It used to be the Théâtre des Ambassadeurs, where Cole Porter also put on a show together with briefly George Gershwin and Good Gershwin's sister in the Revue des Ambassadeurs. That's in the same place, it's still there. And then, of course, he loved Paris. Doris Day singing. So many people have sung this song, but this is Doris Day singing. Songs about Paris, were they the dreamy, nostalgic way, or the ooh-la-la, risque way, but Paris was the subject of so many of Cole Porter's songs. But Paris was for him a place he loved for itself, but it was also a place from which he could leave because he had this, as I mentioned earlier, this lust for travelling, the wanderlust. And the place in Paris, which he found very congenial, was a wonderful restaurant in the railway station from where the train bleu, the blue train, leaves the Gare de Lyon. So that was 1 foot in Paris and 1 foot already on the way with paintings of the places that he was going to go to on the walls of the restaurant of the Gare de Lyon, of which I'll show you a few. Destinations, for example, like Antibes that he went to from there. And he always travelled in great style, stacks of luggage, much more than this. And valets and chauffeurs and butlers. In Japan once he was unhappy with the local rail service, so he chartered a whole train to take him around Japan. I mean, he lived it up. He gave his wife at one stage in their life a new black Cadillac every year, gave her a Rolls Royce now and then. He really lived it up and spent it and a lot of it while on the road traveling. But he always took his piano with him. He worked and played at the same time. Here he is with his good friend Murphy from Yale. A lovely book written about them called Living Well is the Best Revenge, the Murphy family. And he took them down to the Riviera, to Antibes, and they just fell in love with Antibes and invited Scott Fitzgerald. And through Cole Porter, the Riviera around Antibes was relaunched as a summer resort because it had been a winter resort. People went there in wintertime, in Lord Rubens' time. But it was relaunched as a summer resort, partly by Cole Porter being the pathfinder to Antibes as a summer resort. So Scott Fitzgerald, of course, wrote so much about Scott Fitzgerald, about Tender is the Night is all set in that part of the world. And then Venice was a great attraction, naturally. Many of the aristocracy in Paris had palazzi in Venice. And Cole Porter was very fond of Venice. There he is with Bernard Berenson, the famous art critic, second from the right. Sturgis, his friend on the right. Cole Porter on the left and his wife on a gondola in Venice. And a person who played a big part. McCartney's life was this. Society has tells her Maxwell on the right. A rather strange looking woman, but who was a great party organizer. She threw parties, and threw a PR, you might say, or one of the early events managers. She put on great parties in Paris, in Venice, in New York, at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel, maybe a free apartment, because she attracted so many people. And she and Phil were a close team. He got down to the piano and thumped the piano, and she organized the parties. And of course, in Venice, they rented lots of gondolas. They paid for jazz bands to come in and make a sort of a hullabaloo in Venice. Elsa Maxwell was hired by the government to relaunch a certain beach, the Lido Beach in Venice. And the porters and others rented these wonderful places like the Caro Zonico, which is where Robert Browning died, and Byron lived just opposite, so it must have taken Carl Porter back to his younger days. And this was a really grand place where they had regular parties. This was the ballroom of the Caro Zonico with Tiepolo paintings all around. Could have 1,000 people in one go overlooking the Grand Canal. And they had one particularly wild party there. The police were called in because they were making such a pandemonium in the Zonico, and the police chief was humiliated to find that amongst the young men dressed in drag at the party was his own son. Here's Carl Porter with Noel Coward. Of course, beach, living on the beach was a thing. Coco Chanel launched the suntan, which hadn't been fashionable to the suntan until the 1920s. The beach life really took off in the roaring 20s. And here are three beach boys, Carl Porter on the right, Noel Coward, and Jack Wilson on the left, who later became a producer and put on Carl Porter Play 20, 30 years later, after Wilson had married a Russian princess. Carl Porter's first big hit on Broadway, because constantly he kept his eye, although he was living in Paris, he kept writing, trying Broadway, launching plays in London and Paris and Broadway. His first big hit was actually called Paris, with a French singer called Irene Bordoni, whose husband was the producer, so he wanted to showcase her, and Carl Porter wrote the music, so that was his first big. We're now in the late 20s and early 30s, so Carl Porter shuffled between composing on deck as well, settled between New York and Paris in the 30s, and then moved more and more to New York, because as his career started taking off, he found more challenges and work in New York. So the Carl Porter song starts dealing more and more with American topics, Ella Fitzgerald, Oscar Peterson, jazz people, and so on, more took up Carl Porter's music. And one of his plays is called The New Yorkers. And it's one of these many scandalous songs about love for sale, about prostitution, actually. It was banned from the radio in America. Yeah, this is Billie Holiday singing.
For sale. Love that's fresh and still unspoiled. Love that's only slightly soiled. Love.
Now you can see why he was seen as rather scandalous. Many of these songs were censored, not allowed to be shown on the radio, and asked to be rewritten for some of his films, but he always was on the edge, being provocative, misbehaving. But he lived, of course, always in the grandest style. He lived in had an apartment in the Waldorf Towers next to the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in Manhattan. Here's a picture from the Time, top hats and all that, in the Waldorf Astoria Hotel. In the song, in the film about him, Kevin Kline plays Fortuna installing his wife in the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in New York.
Hello, Fortuna.
Hello, Fortuna.
In the roaring traffic, boom, in the silence of
music, musical comedy, which captures the spirit of the 20s and 30s, is anything goes, shipboard romance, as I mentioned earlier, all kinds of improbable characters, a gangster dressed up as a clergyman, and an evangelist dressed up as a nightclub singer, all the improbables that go on shipboard. One of his greatest hits together with Kiss Me, Kate, the two that have survived the best. So it's been revived on... Climax. I don't think anyone can recognize any of those people there. I had a very short-lived career. That's Rhodes University. And of course, what else, anything goes, but I was shuffled off the stairs really rapidly. And I instead went traveling, instead of trying to travel, like Cole Porter, and this incessant desire to travel that I mentioned earlier, around the world, trips all over, up the mountains, watching this lake, going to that city, coming to Cape Town really briefly. On the way down to Cape Town, they stopped off in Zanzibar, and the Sultan of Zanzibar received Cole Porter and his group, and they ushered in, and they were hoping for something really oriental, instead of which he put on the gramophone record and played Night and Day to them. and working as well as having a lot of fun on the trip. Yeah, Franconia and many of the other. And yeah, Cole Porter is at another one of his traveling expeditions. The chap on the right, Ed Tarch, an architect, was apparently inspired by the song "You Be So Easy to Love," but that might just be one of many different versions of the inspiration of that song. One always has to be careful in tying up inspiration with the actual work. Cole Porter once said, "The only inspiration I need is a phone call from a TV from a Hollywood producer telling me he wants a show for me, and that's inspiration." Here he is in Mykonos, again on his many travels. I read to you all the places that he covers, that he mentions in his... And here's some evocation of travel, begin and begin. Bing Crosby.
The beginning. It brings back the sound of music so tender. It brings back an eye tropical splendor. It brings back a memory. I'm with you once more under the stars. And now by the star, an orchestra's playing. And even the palms seem to be swaying when they begin.
The Begin was a song that was came from Martinique, and he heard it perhaps there or perhaps in Paris. So it evokes, you know, memories, troubled memories and so on. But I'd like to play you another version just to show the way that the same song, this was Bing Crosby, Bing Crosby and Mooney, the same song in roughly the same period was given a jazzy treatment with Glenn Miller in the background, and I'm sure you might recognize these ladies. So he was taken over by swing and jazz band artists. His music always seemed to keep abreast of the latest musical trends. The last years of his life, he actually moved from Paris to Broadway. The main action, the Dream Factory, changed from being Broadway to Hollywood. As the talkies took off, Hollywood was where the action was, where the money was. So he spent the last large part of his life in Hollywood. He loved the climate and the swimming pools and Malibu and things that people enjoy in Hollywood. And here's a picture of him with Ann Miller and Catherine Grayson. I don't know if those names mean anything, but Catherine Grayson was in Can-Can, singing with Howard Keel. We'll see a poster of her later. Many of his musical comedies, like Can-Can, we changed from Broadway musical comedies into movies. There's a movie version after the Broadway version. And then his last really big hit, together with Anything Goes, was Kiss Me, Kate. Based, of course, on Shakespeare's Taming of the Shrew. Kate Middleton. That was the one which had brush up your Shakespeare, start quoting him now, brush up your Shakespeare, and the girls move on. And if you meet the wife of the British ambassador, just try her out on Troilus and Cressida, and those kind of things. Kiss Me, Kate was a really, really, really big hit. Funnily enough, Prommer, the very celebrated English poet of the time, W.H. Auden, who was professor of poetry at Oxford, after seeing Kiss Me, Kate, said, actually, Cole Porter has improved on Shakespeare. And he lived in, Cole Porter lived near Marilyn Monroe and got to know her very well. And this is her being a sort of a striptease for a naughty song.
Thank you.
really provocative songs. I think in Joe Porter's case, too, you could have rather adapted that to "My Heart Belongs to Mummy" and his mummy substitute, Linda, his wife. But anyway, that's Marilyn Monroe's version. As I said, Joe Porter lived in Brentwood, a suburb of Hollywood, where Marilyn Monroe lived. She came to premieres of his plays and so on. And Clark Gable and many other Hollywood personalities lived there. So Hollywood is where he liked to be, quite a trial. Nonetheless, he composed for Hollywood. Here the line introducing High Society. So that was one of his great films with, of course, star-studded cast, and not only Satchmo, but Bing Crosby, Frank Sinatra, and above all, the future Princess of Monaco. And the song which Bing Crosby and Grace Kelly sing is said to have been inspired by Cole's wife, the famous True Love. Even after rock and roll had changed the musical landscape, music got much more tough and jump around. But songs like High Society were sung by the rock and rollers, and even more mawkish than Bing Crosby was the version done by Elvis Presley himself.
Forever, I'll ask you.
Thanks for being patient. Thank you.